Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, I'm Benjamin Galloway, Assistant Federal Defender, on behalf of Appellant Mark Turner. At issue in this case is whether the District Court erred in denying Mr. Turner's motion to terminate supervised release on the basis that his supervised release had not begun during his post-sentence detention under the Walsh Act. Section 3624E, which governs the commencement and tolling of supervised release, provides that supervised release begins upon release from imprisonment and thereafter runs except during periods of imprisonment in connection with a conviction. In this case, there's no dispute that Mr. Turner's term of imprisonment expired on September 7, 2007, and the government concedes that his custody thereafter was not any part of his criminal sentence.
But he remained in custody of the Bureau of Prisons, correct?
That's correct, pursuant to civil detention under the Walsh Act. And the Supreme Court in Comstock described the civil nature of Walsh Act detention as a modest addition to a set of mental health statutes designed to provide for the post-sentence detention of the mentally ill. So the question before this Court is whether or not this post-sentence civil detention under the Walsh Act can somehow be construed as imprisonment, and imprisonment in connection with a conviction under 3624E. I would submit the language of the statute in this Court's decisions in Morales-Alejo, Sullivan, and Miller answer that question in the negative. The Court in Morales-Alejo focused on the terms imprisonment and imprisoned as consistently used to describe penalty or sentence, contrasting it to detention, which is a mechanism used to describe a mechanism to preserve the safety of the community. In Sullivan, this Court again focuses on 3624E's focus on the type of confinement rather than the mere fact of confinement. And again in Miller, the Court notes that the crucial issue is whether or not the detention is part of imprisonment. At least four district courts have considered this issue and determined that a civil detainee's post-sentence civil detention under the Walsh Act pre-commitment did not serve to toll their supervised release.
May I ask you one question? I understand the argument in trying to put the two statutes together that your client, who actually had a hearing, correct?
He did have a hearing and was ruled released as of Friday. There's a 14-day appeal period. So unless that release order is stayed, he should be released a week from Friday.
So for your client, how long was he in the civil detention post-release from imprisonment?
About 4.5 years, from September 7, 2007 until Friday.
And his supervised release term is?
22 months.
22 months. So if it were to run, he would be done with his supervised release now. Right?
He would have completed it July 7, 2009.
So the two questions I have. One goes back to the Supreme Court's decision in Johnson, which was a little bit different case, but writing for the court there, Justice Kennedy said, supervised release does not run while an individual remains in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons. So I would have less concern about your argument if I didn't have that statement by Justice Kennedy. Your client, although not imprisoned, was in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And I'd raise several points about Johnson. It's, of course, the case the government and the district court rely so heavily on in support of their position. First, Johnson is a pre-4248 case, which does not address indefinite civil detention under the Walsh Act because the Walsh Act didn't exist in its form at the time. Secondly, Johnson was entirely in the context of imprisonment in connection with a conviction. Mr. Johnson served his sentence of imprisonment till the day he was released. By contrast, Mr. Turner completed service of his sentence of imprisonment years before his release next Friday, if that does occur. Importantly, Johnson limits itself by its own language. Johnson says there can be little doubt about the meaning of release in the context of imprisonment. Of course, the context here is different from the release of imprisonment. Mr. Turner remains in the custody of the Attorney General and the Bureau of Prisons, but not as part of his imprisonment. And as the court in Miller told us, context provides important distinctions. Again, Sullivan and Miller consider this issue post-Johnson, and they hold that it's not the fact of confinement, but the type of confinement that's at issue. And here we don't have imprisonment.
The reality is that if you take the government's position, then presumably there could be an indefinite postponement, tolling of any supervised or supervision if somebody's held 10 years, 20 years, whatever. It would just never start. Is that correct?
That's precisely right. That's one of the key problems with the government's position. By construing this post-sentence detention as imprisonment, it runs afoul of the ex post facto clause, for starters, which prohibits Congress from enacting any punishment greater than existed for the act at the time it was committed. In this case, the maximum penalty Mr. Turner could serve in imprisonment is 2 years.
The other thing is that there is some intellectual collision when you think of supervised release, and then you say, well, but actually he gets credit for being in the civil holding detention, so therefore he can't be under the supervisory release statute, as it says, it can't be released by the Bureau of Prisons to the supervision of a probation officer. So do we just ignore that language, or how do we give meaning to the two statutes in congruity?
I would refer the court to the decisions in Sullivan and Miller, which address this issue after Johnson. And in Sullivan and Miller, the courts recognize that it's not necessary that the individual be free and walking the streets to be on supervised release. Both of those individuals were detained in a county halfway house or pre-release facility. Sullivan, not any part of his federal sentence of imprisonment. Miller, as part of his federal sentence of imprisonment. This court held that in Sullivan, his supervised release did run because he was not detained as part of his federal sentence of imprisonment. By contrast, Miller's did not. And so this court recognizes that you can be detained and be on supervised release, as the court had in Morales-Alejo prior to that, and also in the context of immigration detention, where you can also be on supervised release, but in the custody of the Attorney General.
Would you want to save your remaining time?
Yes, please, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right. Here we go. Now we'll turn to the case of United States versus Bolander. Mr. Brennan, are you ready?
Okay, yeah, I'm ready, thank you. I'm at a slight disadvantage, Your Honor, because we lost our transmission during co-counsel's argument, and we just got it back, so
okay. Well,
unfortunately.
Well, I can say that he eloquently argued the principles that were in his brief with some flourish.
Well, that's good news.
I don't think anything he said would be of surprise to you. Let's put it that way.
You okay. Would like it, and you can actually be here next time if you want to.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry I'm not there. It's a beautiful place.
Well, I think this is the second or third case that I've heard where you've done this, where you asked to be there because you've got a junior high daughter or something like that, and we applaud your parenthood, but understand that when you do it this way, there are some disadvantages.
I understand.
You may proceed.
I don't know. I want to join my co-counsel's arguments, but I don't want to repeat the arguments that he made, so I'm going to be brief. And basically, I think that the outcome of this case is controlled and dictated by your colleague's opinion in Morales-Alejo. That case is controlling. It was decided in 1999. And I think that with respect to the two statutes, 3624 and 4248, the government tries to conflate those together. And actually, they're like two individual trains, parallel trains, with different arrival points and different arrival times. There's no real intersection there. 3624 deals with the expiration of a prison term, and 4248 has to do with civil detainment procedures. I don't see any reason or in logic or fact to conflate those statutes in the way that the government suggests.
May I ask a question as to your client? I understand your client is still in the civil detention status, is that right?
He's been committed, Your Honor, on January 19th, 2012, 5 years after being detained beyond his prison term. He had a hearing, a commitment hearing, and was committed.
My question was this. Since he is in the civil detention status, is your argument or your client's case ripe? Because we don't have a situation where he's going to be released, and then we need to know, does he have to go on supervised release or does he not have to go on supervised release? So I'm asking it because it's, and I'm not saying it'll happen, but what if your client were detained there for his lifetime? This would never become an issue, correct? What would be, so if there is some consequence at this point, perhaps you could articulate that for us.
Well, that theoretically, that's correct, but I think there is a consequence. I think it is ripe because if and when he's released, he then will face the problem of having to face a criminally generated supervised release or will be released free and clear from his civil commitment. So I think it very definitely is ripe. And to make him go through an extended litigation after, at some future point when he is released, would be a tremendous burden on his civil liberties. So yes, I do think it's ripe, and it's not clear what's going to happen in the future, but I think the court needs to decide that issue now so that if and when he's released, he knows where he stands. Will not be facing extended litigation to answer the question that we're asking the court to answer today.
Thank you.
I think with that, if there's no more questions, I will reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
All right. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. Richard Friedman for the government in both cases. When a prisoner is certified under 4248, the filing of the certification shall stay his release. The stay deprives BOP of the power to release him from imprisonment. It can change his conditions of confinement, but it does not and cannot release him from imprisonment.
May I stop right there? Do you distinguish between imprisonment and confinement in a civil context under 4248?
Yes. After the petition to commit him is granted, as did happen in Mr. Bollinger's case, when that order becomes effective, the order, by its terms, transfers his custody from BOP to the Attorney General under 4248. That becomes a civil commitment, and the Supreme Court has already decided, and we don't contest, that a civil commitment is not imprisonment, so his supervised release begins. If he's released because the petition for commitment is denied, he has been released from imprisonment by the order of the court, and his supervised release begins.
So that's where I'm having some trouble, okay? So I just want to tell you, in trying to put these together, the supervised release statute says that a prisoner shall be released on the date of expiration of the prisoner's term of imprisonment. Is it your view that the Walsh Act actually can extend the term of imprisonment for a criminal conviction?
No. It does not extend the term of imprisonment,
okay,
but
so
it
then
stays.
Let's go back. It stays the release. Okay. So you can be imprisoned, and you could complete your imprisonment, but remain in the custody of the Bureau of prisons, correct?
Correct. Because the statute happens to use a legal term, stay. A stay deprives the actor of power. Congress might have done what the appellants are arguing. It might have said, upon the certification, the person will be transferred to a civil pre-commitment custodian. It didn't do that. The plain meaning also serves the policies of both supervised release and 4248. Before a respondent can be committed on a 4248 petition, the district court, in this case in North Carolina, must make a finding that the person will have serious difficulty refraining from sexually violent behavior or child molestation. In Mr. Turner's case, the district court in fact relied on his terms of supervised release to provide enough supervision so that he would be able to refrain if supervised release did not apply, according to our view of the plain meaning of the statute. More respondents will get committed because otherwise they will be released with no supervision.
Counsel, what troubles me is the, when you look at the language of 3624C, or maybe it's E, I apologize, it indicates a term of supervised release does not run during any period in which the person is imprisoned in connection with a conviction for a federal, state, or local crime, unless the imprisonment is for a period of less than 30 consecutive days. So in the circumstance we're talking about here, someone is convicted for the commission of one of these crimes. A stay comes in accordance with the act that you talk about, and then the person is civilly committed. They don't ever leave. It's just a different, one civil, one is criminal. But the statute that I just cited, 3624E, talks about that the release period doesn't run during a period the person is committed for the conviction of a crime. Once that's served, even if it stayed, you've transferred to a civil commitment. They're no longer there based upon the commission of the crime. So how then does this statute stay the running of the supervised release period?
The provision you referred to is a tolling provision.
Right.
In our view, applies only once supervised release has begun. If I may, let me explain the government's view of the three stages of when supervised release starts and stops.
Okay.
First, it cannot possibly run while the term of imprisonment is continuing because it has been imposed to run after the term of imprisonment. So, for example, when BOP releases a prisoner during his term of imprisonment to a work release program, he is not on supervised release because his term of imprisonment has not expired. That's the Miller case. Once his term of imprisonment has expired, he may go
the
on
term of imprisonment for the crime.
That's correct.
Right.
His term of imprisonment for the offense for
right.
which he has been ordered to serve a term of supervised
right.
release.
Okay.
And that's basically the judgment entered by the district court.
Correct. And that's the Miller case.
Yes.
After his term of imprisonment has expired, supervised release may begin, but only when he is actually released from imprisonment by whoever is holding him in imprisonment. And this turns to Sullivan. In Sullivan, the person is held in a state prison, serving both his federal and state sentences. His federal sentence expires. Now he might start to serve supervised release when he is released from imprisonment. The state releases him to a halfway house. Under federal law, halfway house confinement is not imprisonment. So his federal supervised release begins, even though under state law, he is still serving his state term of imprisonment while in the halfway house. Stage three.
But that's still based upon conviction of a crime and imprisonment for the crime, right?
At that stage, he was imprisoned on the state crime. When he was
right.
released from that imprisonment, if he's released to something that is not imprisonment, supervised release begins. Now the third stage.
Again, my struggle here.
Correctly.
Is
we're getting now to the third stage.
The predicate of the crime. Okay, go ahead.
We're getting now to the third stage. After supervised release has begun, if he is re-imprisoned, supervised release will only toll if that re-imprisonment is in connection with a conviction. So if he's picked up by the local police and put in jail, he's imprisoned there, but not in connection with a crime. And if he's denied bail, he's imprisoned, but not in connection with a crime, and that's Morales. Now, here's what happens in the 4248 case. He was imprisoned while serving his sentence. Before the sentence expired, the 4248 stay deprived the Bureau of Prisons of the power to release him from imprisonment. There might be an argument that that's unconstitutional, that you can't hold a pre-commitment person in jail, that instead you have to transfer them to a civil custodian. But if that argument were made and succeeded, what would happen for supervised release? That other court would order him released, and it would begin when he was actually released, not when he should have been released. So what has happened under this statutory scheme, because Congress used the term stay, a stay deprives an actor of power. The Bureau of Prisons had the responsibility and the power to release him on the expiration of his term of imprisonment, but then the stay took that power away. And he is still imprisoned until the district court in the Eastern District of North Carolina rules on the petition.
Okay, so let's stop there, because it doesn't use the word imprisonment. If you go to the top of the Walsh Act, at the top of it, it says, a person who is in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons, and you could be in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons for a variety, immigration, detention, all kinds of things. You might be in the custody, correct, and not be imprisoned. Isn't that true?
As we understand that provision, the custody of the Bureau of Prisons must be legal custody serving a term of imprisonment. For example,
Where do you get that? That's how you understand it. Well, where does it say that?
The Fourth Circuit has had an opportunity to interpret the provision, and in a case called Joshua, it held that when you had a military prisoner convicted of a court-martial, and he was being housed in a Bureau of Prisons facility and was in BOP custody, that was not custody for purposes of 4248 because he was convicted of a military crime, not a federal crime. Now, one might differ about that interpretation, but we are ceding to that is the meaning of custody.
But my point is this. If you said, well, it might be unconstitutional, but so what almost? Well, that is a big problem. My concern is that it is potentially unconstitutional if you have somebody who has a criminal sentence and you're supposed to be released from your criminal sentence and you say, no, you're still under your criminal sentence until such time as we get around to giving you a hearing and decide if you should go into civil commitment. My question is why, at the conclusion of, in order to save this from an unconstitutional interpretation, why at the conclusion of your imprisonment, and you are not supposed to be imprisoned longer than the court ordered you, why at the conclusion of that are you not in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons, but not necessarily imprisoned on your criminal conviction? Why are you not now in what I'll call civil land?
You are not imprisoned in connection with your original conviction. You are imprisoned because the Bureau has been told not to release you from imprisonment. Now,
well,
it is, we don't believe
it's... from custody. It doesn't say anything about imprisonment.
Well, it says it shall stay his release.
Now, that's different,
but
though.
See, that's different. That's why
we understand.
Saying, okay, it doesn't say I'm going to add to your sentence. It's going to say I can't let you out right now. Okay. And the reason I can't let you out is that I have this statute, which has been declared in broad terms the ability to civilly commit somebody for sexual offense. I have the statute with these procedures, and it's because of this statute which kicks in a civil procedure that I can't let you out of my prison, right?
Okay. But if I may, Your Honor, we are not arguing that it is extending his term of imprisonment on his original sentence. We are saying that the way the stay provision works is that he stays imprisoned Now, the Bureau happens, quite intelligently, to change his conditions of confinement so that they comport with the due process requirements for somebody who was being held but not imprisoned on a term of imprisonment. However, we are simply giving a plain meaning to the term stay, because stay is a term of art. And we caution them.
You told me that they keep them in confinement so that they're not under a term of imprisonment, which is sort of what I was saying.
Well, if Congress had provided to transfer the custody to a civil custodian under 4248, that would be the result. But we caution that that would be inconsistent with both the purposes of supervised release and the purposes of 4248, because if the petition for commitment is denied, the person would be released with no supervision, and a court viewing the petition for a commitment would tend to commit more people, because it would be saying, this person is either going to go out scot-free with no supervision.
Counsel, I'm really struggling, I think, with the same issues that Judge McEwen is here. When you look at 3624E, it talks about imprisonment, the predicate being a conviction for a crime. You speak of a stay. The stay has to do with whether the person is released from jail. But at that point, the person is confined based upon a civil commitment. They're quite different. And so the fact that you have stayed the person doesn't mean that the imprisonment under 3624E is continuing. You've got a new basis for holding them that the Supreme Court has upheld.
The distinction.
But the fact that it stayed, if anything, trips you up, I think, because you're not extending the prison term. That gets into the constitutional issues that Judge McEwen mentioned before. So I don't, I'm having real difficulty seeing how 3624E gets continued into the civil, what do you call it, civil land or
no commitment
land?
I call it civil land.
Civil land, all right.
Well, the premise of our statutory construction on that point is that the provision for imprisonment in connection with a conviction is solely a tolling provision. But that's important.
But that's
it only
what the
comes
case
into
is about, isn't it?
No, because it only comes into play once supervised release has begun. In this case, the issue is, when does it begin? It begins on release from imprisonment if the 4248 stay is construed as a direction to the BOP to transfer the prisoner to a civilian custodian, then his supervised release would begin. And that's what happens when he is committed.
Counsel, with respect, you're misconstruing 3624, because this says the term of supervised release does not run during any period in which the person is imprisoned in connection with a conviction for a federal, state, or local crime. What we're talking about here is that period is over. We'll say that's day X. On day X, the conviction or the imprisonment for that crime is over. And normally, then this period of supervised release would begin. You say the government comes in, gets a stay, but just stay as to confinement. It continues to be whatever you want to call it. If the person is imprisoned, the person is not imprisoned based upon the crime. The person is imprisoned or confined based upon the terms of the Walsh Act.
We do not read that sentence about tolling in isolation. The beginning of sub E describes when the supervised release begins. It begins on release from imprisonment. And then the tolling provision.
Release from imprisonment for conviction of the crime.
We disagree. The language of the statute does not say release from imprisonment in connection with a conviction. And this is key.
That's what it does say.
No, it does not. Supervised.
I'm just reading it.
Supervised release begins on release from imprisonment. Next sentence.
No.
You're reading two different sentences.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at E. And that says, does not run during any period in which the person is imprisoned in connection with a conviction for a federal, state, or local crime.
Unless it's less than 30 days.
First sentence of E. Where it says, a prisoner whose term of release includes a term of imprisonment includes a term of supervised release, shall be released by the Bureau of Prisons at the expiration. So that's their obligation. And then it says, the term of supervised release commences on the day the person is released from imprisonment. It does not say released from imprisonment in connection with a conviction. So his supervised release begins when he's released from imprisonment.
Correct. And that's where we come down to the collision between custody and imprisonment, because the Walsh Act talks about custody, not imprisonment. And if you're certified under Section A of the Walsh Act, there's no time limit on when you can have your hearing, correct?
Well, there is, actually.
How long?
There is a due process limit.
Okay, well, some outer limit, yeah. Which...
Now, the...
But it could be years,
the
right?
Delays were substantial because of the Comstock litigation, but no longer so. I can represent to the court that now that the Comstock has decided on the constitutionality of this, and now that the backlog is cleared, the Bureau is certifying persons long before the expiration of their term of imprisonment, and there's a standing order in the Eastern District of North Carolina that all these cases must be brought to trial on the commitment petition within 110 days. And I may represent to the court that I have been told by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Eastern North Carolina that the recently filed cases...
The Attorney's about to get... He's been held there for a long time.
Has he?
Able to get out, because after being held a long time, they actually certified or had hearings to say, you know, he wasn't a problem. And so now, having been held in the custody of the Bureau, your position is he still needs to have supervised release. Correct?
Yes, and this situation actually was addressed in Johnson toward the end of the opinion. If there is an inequity because he has been held beyond his proper term of imprisonment because of these delays, he could petition to the supervised release court, which is the sentencing court, and ask for a modification of his duration or of his conditions of supervised release. And if it were appropriate, it would be granted.
I guess the government would support that in light of the long delay, is that?
No, actually in these cases, if we had the option of releasing a sexual predator on conditions of supervised release, which would help restrain him from acting out on those proclivities, or instead releasing him with no conditions, we would be arguing to the sentencing court that although it was very unfortunate that it took so long because of the Comstock litigation.
So it's a little disingenuous for you to sit here and say, oh, just hop on down to the sentencing court and ask for some relief, because the government would oppose that.
Yes, we would, but
okay,
the
so
statutory framework.
So I don't think it's fair for you to sit here and tell us, don't, you know, trust us. Well, we had a big due process problem, and now we fixed that. You can always get relief in the sentencing court, but of course we would oppose that. So, I mean, when you come here on behalf of the government, I think you have an obligation to not necessarily take this to the nth degree, but to take it to do what's right in connection with the statute. And I think that it's disingenuous for the government to make the representation you just made here. If you don't want to support a release, fine, but don't tell the court that there's another safety valve for this defendant when in fact there's not.
If there might be in a case where the defendant showed there was no merit whatsoever to the petition for commitment, and he shows, I don't need any supervision, and I shouldn't be held to my term of supervised release because of that. Now, that would be an appropriate case. And I don't believe, Your Honor, that I'm being disingenuous to the court. I'm trying to convey the current state of affairs. Let us suppose...
Okay, I think you've well exceeded your time. Yeah. We've asked you a lot of questions. So
thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, we appreciate your
argument. We appreciate it. I mean, it's a complicated statute, even though it looks simple.
I would say this. I read Kafka's The Trial many years ago, and this case brings it all back.
You may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you. It's important to note that Section 4248 does not operate to stay release from imprisonment. It stops short of that. It says stay release. And so from that point on, we have to look at whether or not we're talking about release from imprisonment in the context of 3624E or release in the context of the Walsh Act. The government's entire argument hangs on an erroneous conflation of those two things. And I think it really flies in the face of the government's arguments preserving the Walsh Act in other cases, saying it's not imprisonment, it's civil in nature. Sure, it may be a little punitive, but it's not imprisonment, it's civil detention. Well, this then is 4.5 years of civil detention. It's not imprisonment, and for the government to say that it is now is in direct contradiction to those other cases. I would refer the court to the district court's decision from Alaska and Brown, which took this issue head on and said that staying one's release from imprisonment in connection with the conviction under 3624E is distinct from staying one's release under the Walsh Act. One is
would you agree that there, at least as a practical matter, would undermine potentially the district court's view of supervised release, which is I'd like to put this person into the community, but I want to monitor them and make sure everything, you know, no more crimes are committed, and particularly that they're abiding by other terms in terms of proximity to schools or children or things like that. If they're just held in civil detention, you never get to play out the supervised release.
That is a conundrum created by the statute, Your Honor. I would point out that communities throughout the country have taken ample steps that have been litigated throughout the courts to account for those things, such as 290 registration, internet registration, stay away from all such things as schools and communities. And the laws now, given the focus on this issue, are, I would submit, more than enough to address that issue. But I think what it comes down to is that to construe this as staying released from imprisonment, as Morales-Alejo says, imprisonment is penalty or sentence, it simply undermines the government's argument to preserve the constitutionality of the Walsh Act. They can't have it both ways.
So on that, I'd submit it.
And we have to construe this law presumably in a way, if possible, that avoids the constitutional issue, right?
I would think that's right, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Brennan, do you want to proceed with rebuttal?
Yes. I want to address the court's question regarding, well, what happens if they're committed, they're released, and then there's no supervised release. And I would like to point to 4248 and the restrictions, the severe restrictions, and that statute imposes on anybody committed under the Walsh Act. Confinement in the federal facility will last until either the person's mental condition improves to the point where he is no longer dangerous, with or without appropriate ongoing treatment, in which case he will be released, or the state assumes responsibility for his care and treatment. The Walsh Act also provides for conditional release if they feel that somebody is a danger. It provides for revocation if somebody, for example, violates in some way. It in fact imposes more restrictions than supervised release does on people that are committed and then to under the Act. There is a stringent, under the terms of the statute, a stringent procedural regimen that they have to follow before anybody would ever be released under the Act. And that I propose or submit takes the place of supervised release and is probably maybe more effective in terms of dealing with this particular issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The two cases just argued, United States versus Turner and United States versus Bolander, are submitted. I want to thank all the counsel for your argument. It's a very complicated, interesting statute. We will now adjourn the court session, but we will remain to answer questions from the students. We will not entertain any questions about the cases themselves or the substance of the cases, but we're happy to answer questions about the Ninth Circuit, about appellate argument, life, or anything else you want to ask. So the floor is open.